All right. So as our brother just mentioned in his prayer, and thank you for that, we're going to be studying John's gospel account of the resurrection this morning as we conclude our study in the book of John. So if you're visiting with us, welcome. And I can't think of a more joyful topic that we could spend the next 45 minutes talking about on this Sunday morning. So we're going to be talking about another Sunday morning, the first day of the week. The first day of the week when really everything changed and new life was given and given abundantly. So with that, let's begin by looking at the scene at the empty tomb. And if you would, let's just read it together, and I'll read the first 10 verses here of chapter 20. It says, "Now on the first day of the week, Mary Magdalene came to the tomb early, while it was still dark, and saw that the stone had been taken away from the tomb. And so she ran, and she went to Simon Peter, the other disciple, the one whom Jesus loved, and said to them, 'They have taken the Lord out of the tomb, and we do not know where they have laid him.' So Peter went out with the other disciple, and they were going toward the tomb. Both of them were running together, but the other disciple outran Peter and reached the tomb first. And stooping to look in, he saw the linen cloths lying there, but he did not go in. And then Simon Peter came, following him, and he went into the tomb. And he saw the linen cloths lying there, the face cloth which had been on Jesus' head, not lying with the linen cloths, but folded up in a place by itself. And then the other disciple who had reached the tomb first also went in, and he saw and believed. For as yet they did not understand the scripture that he must rise from the dead. And then the disciples went back to their homes." All right, so here we are at the beginning. We have Mary Magdalene, who she's there. The other gospel accounts tell us that she is there with some other women. But it's Mary Magdalene and these other women who are perhaps among Jesus's most devoted disciples. And so they are there to tend to his body in the tomb. And we know from the other accounts when Mary is going to the tomb, her primary concern is the stone. How is she going to have the stone rolled away so that they can care for Jesus' body? But of course, when they get there, they find that the stone is already rolled away and it is moved. So who is Mary Magdalene? Well, she is, we know from the other gospel accounts that Mary is... Again, she's one of Jesus' most devoted disciples. She's among the women who traveled with Jesus and his disciples and cared for them and provided for them. And Luke 8, verse 2 tells us another fact about her, that she was also one that Jesus had healed. It said he had cast out demons from her. So she is one of the very few disciples that's mentioned by name in all four gospel accounts. And her importance is this event right here. She is the primary, the first witness to the resurrection. She is the first to see the risen Jesus. And that's the story we will read about here in just a minute. But what she finds initially is not Jesus. She finds an empty tomb. And then we have this scene where there's a lot of running. So I know we've got some runners here, not me, but we have some runners. I'm sure they're pleased to know we've got running here in the gospel. So Mary runs. She runs to go get Peter and John. I think she's running because she doesn't understand what she's found. She's found an empty tomb. His body is supposed to be there. Her initial reaction, I think, is maybe what anyone would have suspected, that, well, where's his body? His body's been taken. So she runs and gets Peter and John. Peter and John, upon hearing this news, they run back to the tomb. Here, I do think you get a little flavor of a friendly rivalry between Peter and John, because John points out he wins this race. So John gets there first. But interestingly, John gets there first, and you get this picture, he's almost too cautious, too hesitant to actually go in. But he looks in, and it says, "Stooping to look in, he saw the linen cloths lying there, but he did not go in." All right, so right off the bat, here's kind of an important detail that John gives us. The cloths are there, but Jesus' body is not. You might think it would seem likely if someone had just taken the body, they'd take him with the cloths. They wouldn't go to the trouble to unwrap him leave the cloths there and then leave. But John doesn't go in. Peter, getting there second in this race, sort of bold Peter as we know him, goes right into the tomb. And when he goes in, he gets a closer look at the cloths, and he sees that, in fact, the face cloth has been sort of neatly folded, and it's lying in a place by itself. So again, not necessarily something you would expect of someone who's just come to steal the body. So again, these are important details about the historical resurrection that John the Apostle was giving to us here. And then in John, in verse 8 here, it says, John, when he comes in, it says he saw and believed. And it says they didn't yet understand the scripture that he must rise from the dead. But John believes, it tells us. So this is the very first scene of this resurrection day. And then we get Mary's perspective. Mary is the initial witness, the primary witness. When we look here through verses 11 through 18, we find Mary's encounter. And it says, "But Mary stood weeping outside the tomb. As she wept, she stooped to look into the tomb, and she saw two angels in white sitting where the body of Jesus had lain, one at the head and one at the feet. And they said to her, 'Woman, why are you weeping?' And she said to them, 'They've taken away my Lord, and I do not know where they have laid him.' Having said this, she turned around and saw Jesus standing, but she did not know that it was Jesus. Jesus said to her, 'Woman, why are you weeping? Whom are you seeking?' Supposing him to be the gardener, she said to him, 'Sir, if you have carried him away, tell me where you have laid him, and I will take him away.' And Jesus said to her, 'Mary.' She turned and said to him in Aramaic, 'Rabboni,' which means teacher. And Jesus said to her, 'Do not cling to me, for I have not yet ascended to my Father, but to my brothers. Go to my brothers and say to them, I am ascending to my Father and your Father, and to my God and your God.' Mary Magdalene went and announced to the disciples, 'I have seen the Lord,' and that he had said these things to her." All right, so this is Mary's encounter. The first thing she sees, she goes into the tomb, and Mary gets a perspective that Peter and John didn't get. So what does Mary see? Mary sees the slab where Jesus' body had lain, and then she sees, it says, two angels, one at the head and one at the foot. And I think this is just sort of my own opinion. I think there's some imagery here even that we're supposed to kind of get an image of, and that Mary's seen sort of an image of the mercy seat. I mean, if you think about the Ark of the Covenant, you have angels on each side. It is the throne. It's the resting place of God. I think John and Mary are getting this picture that there's something more about this man they knew as Jesus, that he, in fact, is the Son of God, that he, in fact, is somehow God and man. And as we go through this chapter, John, the writer, is going to make that even more clear. But I think right now we're supposed to be getting a picture of that with these angels. They ask her, "Why are you weeping?" So from the angel's perspective, this is not an occasion for weeping. Mary doesn't understand it yet, but it's not an occasion for weeping. Then Mary sees Jesus. And this scene, Mary has come to his tomb. Jesus' tomb is in a garden. Last time when we talked about Jesus' crucifixion and his betrayal, that starts in a garden as well. So Jesus is in the garden at night. Judas comes in the night for him. And Jesus asked him, "Whom are you seeking?" Here, after Jesus' ordeal, after the resurrection, now we're in a garden again. Mary is coming to look for Jesus. And Jesus asks her, "Who are you seeking?" It's morning. It's the first morning. It's a new creation in a way. And so Mary thinks he's the gardener. She asks him, "Whom are you seeking?" Which I think, again, there's an important parallel here, sort of bookending this event. And then Jesus lets it be known who he is. So initially she doesn't recognize him. One of the things I think we lose in our translations, most of our Bibles call her Mary throughout. So it says Her name is called Mary. But in the Greek, she's called Mary until Jesus calls her name. And then the name Jesus uses when he says Mary is her given Hebrew name. He says Miriam. And so instead of using the Greek word for Mary, which John has used in his text, he calls her Miriam. And to me, that suggests, you know, perhaps Mary was well known by her Greek name, but Jesus called her, knew her personally by her Hebrew name. He called her her birth name. He called her Miriam. I'm speculating a little bit here, but I think what we do know is Jesus called her the name he always called her, and she recognized him at once as the man she knew as Jesus. And so here we get initially this, I think we get the first flavor of what's going to happen several times in this chapter of there is something recognizable about Jesus. They recognize him as the man they knew. And there's also something unrecognizable about him. There's something new about him. So there's this sense of they recognize him, but they don't recognize him. There's something different about him, but there's something the same. And all of this is leading toward the conclusion we're supposed to draw that he is somehow both man and God. But he calls her by her name, and she turns and recognizes him immediately. And then Jesus also asks her, why are you weeping? Again, I think trying to get through the idea that this is not a time for weeping. And I want you to think back to when we looked in John chapter 16, Jesus told them that this would happen. On the night he was betrayed, when Jesus talked to his disciples in John chapter 16, verse 22, he told them what was going to happen. He said, So you have sorrow now, but I will see you again, and your hearts will rejoice, and no one will take that joy away from you. All right, so this is happening in real time to Mary now. So what he just told his disciples back in chapter 16, that you're going to sorrow, and then you'll see me, and then you'll have joy, and no one can take that joy from you. So he's telling her, why are you weeping? This is a time for joy. And it's a joy that can never be taken from her, because now that Jesus is risen, he's never to die again. And this is what they're coming to realize in the flesh, in person, with their hands and with their eyes and with their ears. And Mary clings to him, and we have this verse that's I think oftentimes confusing to some of us, where he says, "Don't cling to me, for I've not yet ascended to my Father." But I think the point we're supposed to get here is that Jesus was graspable. He's not a spirit. Like, that's the important detail we're supposed to get here. He's very much someone that Mary could grab onto physically and cling to. He's flesh, so he's not a spirit. They haven't seen a ghost. They haven't seen a spirit. They aren't hallucinating. He is, in fact, the risen, bodily risen Jesus, and he is graspable. But he does tell her, don't hang on to me. Now, why is this? I think that's because he is going to be ascending to the Father, and it won't be long. But before that happens, he has work that needs to be done. And the first person he gives a task to here is Mary. And what's he tell her to do? He tells her to go find his disciples and tell them. He says, go tell them what you say to them. I'm ascending to my Father and your Father and to my God and your God. And it says, Mary Magdalene went and announced to the disciples, I have seen the Lord. So there's a very, I know we like to talk about the day of Pentecost as the first gospel sermon, but to me there's a very real sense in which Mary here has the first gospel sermon. That the idea that Jesus has died, he was buried, and he's risen, she's the first person to go and spread the word about this. And she goes and tells the other disciples. And this is exactly what Jesus had asked her to do. And then I think it's interesting what he said to her. He said, I'm ascending to my Father and your Father, to my God and your God. So he says, I'm going back to my Father, but he's also your Father. And again, I want to just look back to the early part of the book of John. John 1 verse 12 says, but to all who did receive him, those who believed in his name, he gave the right to become children of God. Again, this is happening right now to Mary. He's saying this is now, that what has been accomplished on the cross and in the resurrection, my Father is now your Father. So in those who are in him, those who believe in him, now have the right to become children of God. And that's the message he wants her to tell to the disciples, that this has happened now. And then as we close out the resurrection day, now we find the other disciples. So now verse 19 tells us it's the evening. On the evening of that day, the first day of the week, the doors being locked where the disciples were for fear of the Jews, Jesus came and stood among them, and he said to them, "Peace be with you." And when he said this, he showed them his hands and his side, and the disciples were glad when they saw the Lord. Jesus said to them again, "Peace be with you. As the Father has sent me, even so I'm sending you." And when he had said this, he breathed on them, and he said to them, "Receive the Holy Spirit. If you forgive the sins of any, they are forgiven them. But if you withhold the forgiveness from any, it is withheld." All right, so now Jesus is going to show himself to the disciples. And we find the disciples. Where are they? Well, they are all together hiding on the evening of the first day of the week. They're hiding behind locked doors, it says. And Jesus comes into their midst. So they're hiding for fear. They're afraid, it says, for fear of the Jews. John, when he uses this term, often means the Jewish authorities. And I think that's what he means here, because those are the ones who had sent Jesus to Pilate to have him crucified. So we have his disciples. They are still hiding. They believe they are in danger. But Jesus comes among them, and he offers them peace. He says, "Peace be with you." And it says he showed them his hands and his side. So again, we get this sense of Jesus is exactly who they remember as the man Jesus, right down to he still bears the wounds of the cross. But he's also somehow strangely different, because he's come into their midst in a locked room. And so there's a sense where they know him and they don't. Again, I think we're building up to this picture of somehow this mystery of he is both man and God. But it says when they see him, they were glad. So again, he's given them a joy now, right? And this is a joy, once again, that will never be taken away from them. Jesus is never more to die. Even though he still bears the wounds of the cross, he is never more to die. And then Jesus, he has a mission for them as well, for his apostles. So he says, "As my Father sent me, I also send you." This word for send is the same root as apostle. So he is saying, as my Father has sent me, the idea here being sort of an ambassador, a messenger, an envoy, someone who speaks with the same weight and authority as the one who sent him. So for example, the king might send his ambassador, and when the ambassador speaks, he bears the full weight and authority of the king, as though the king himself is delivering the message. That was true of Jesus. So Jesus spoke with the full weight and authority and message of his Father, and now he's designating these apostles to do the same. He's saying, "I will send you." And again, I think if we look back to what Jesus told them before the cross in chapter 16, he told them this would happen as well. He said, "I still have many things to say to you, but you cannot hear them now." This is verse 12 of chapter 16. "When the Spirit of truth comes, he will guide you into all truth, for he will not speak on his own authority, but whatever he hears, he will speak, and he will declare to you the things that are to come. He will glorify me, for he will take what is mine and declare it to you. All that the Father has is mine. Therefore, I said that he will take what is mine and declare it to you." So Jesus told them he would send the Spirit. He would give them the Spirit, and that the Spirit would speak the truth to them and tell them what to say. And so here we have Jesus saying he was sent by God, and now he is sending his apostles. Even though he's going back to the Father, his work will continue. And then we have something which might appear strange, but it says Jesus, when he said this, he breathed on them. But again, think back to the creation account. Think back to what Genesis tells us about how God created man. When you look in Genesis 2, it says God formed man and he breathed life into his nostrils. And here we have Jesus who has this new life, incorruptible life, cannot die again. He has life in a way that is mysterious and they don't understand, and he's breathing his life into them. He's giving them eternal life, and he's giving them, this says, the Spirit. But he's breathing on them the same way God breathed into man at creation. And this is how he gives the gift of the Holy Spirit to his apostles. So now we've wrapped up here the first day, the resurrection day. Does anybody have any comments or questions? Back here with Sister Walton.
I was just wondering, in your studies, was it common for people to come to a grave after someone had been buried to do anything? I mean, he would have been wrapped up. Or did they just put the precious oils on the bandages?
I think if you look back to the prior chapter, you see Nicodemus and Joseph of Arimathea taking him to the grave. And they have quite a lot of spices, right? It says they have 75 pounds of materials. And it also says it was getting late in the day when that happened. So I think very much there may have been work that they still needed to do. And of course they couldn't do it on the Sabbath day. And so here you have Mary the morning after the Sabbath, as soon as she's able, going back to the tomb to tend to the grave. I think that's what we see happening. I don't know if anyone else has thoughts. Mary up here in the front.
Brian, I just absolutely loved your reference about the mercy seat. I thought that was very interesting with the two angels. And that especially also in John 19 and 20, the combination of who the Lord is, the mystery. Paul deals with that in 1 Timothy. He says, "And without controversy, great is the mystery of godliness. God was manifested in the flesh, justified in the spirit, seen by angels, preached among the Gentiles, believed in the world, received up to glory."
That's a great verse. Thank you. Yeah, absolutely. Any other comments or questions? One thing I think, this is just interesting to me about Jesus coming into the locker room. This reminds me, I think it's in Revelation chapter 3, Jesus says he's the one who has the keys of David. And he says that what the doors that he opens are open and the doors that he locks are locked. And I don't know. I think this is just an actual visual representation of that. Jesus is coming in, doors that are locked are open to him, and if he says a door is open, it's opened. And doors that are open that he wants locked, he says they're locked. And here we have him telling his disciples that he has that authority. He's saying, I will forgive and I will withhold forgiveness. We had a comment up here with Brother Willis.
That's Psalm 118, approximately verse 20. David says, "Open the gates of righteousness that I may walk into them." And he finishes that pericope there in about verse 22 when he says, "This is a day the Lord has made. Let us rejoice." The Lord did it.
Yep. Again, a great verse. Another comment?
Yeah, many, many times I've thought about this. How can you be with somebody so long and not recognize them? The problem is they went to their funeral just not very long ago. You might think, you know, the gardener kind of looks like Jesus, but to understand that it really is Jesus, I wondered what the resurrection body looked like, even though he said he shows his hands and he shows his side. I always wondered if it had all of those defects. Mm-hmm. And then the question comes, is that really the resurrection body? All of that's interesting. What matters is that he was resurrected, and he was our sacrifice, and we now have the ability to get forgiveness, or we will soon.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. And I very much believe, and I think we are all to believe, that he was bodily resurrected in his own body. And that's why his body was not in the tomb, and they didn't see a spirit. He's very much someone they can grasp onto. He has the same wounds. He is risen in body. So now we get to Jesus and Thomas. So now we are 8 days later. This is the well-known passage where Thomas gets his, what I think is an unfortunate nickname. John does not call Thomas Doubting Thomas, by the way. He calls him the twin. He says he was, now Thomas, one of the 12, called the twin. So I very much like that. Thomas already has a nickname. He doesn't need another one. But this is where the nickname we call him Doubting Thomas comes from. So we see here in verse 26, the other disciples tell him, "We've seen the Lord." And then he says, "Unless I see in his hands the mark of the nails and place my finger in the mark of the nails and place my hand into his side, I will never believe." So Thomas says, "I need to see it for myself. This is too much. I can't believe this." And then 8 days later, Thomas gets his chance. So it says, 8 days later, his disciples were inside again, and Thomas was with them. And although the doors were locked, Jesus came in and stood among them. And he said, "Peace be with you." And then he said to Thomas, "Put your finger here and see my hands, and put out your hand and place it in my side. Do not disbelieve, but believe." Thomas answered him, "My Lord and my God." And Jesus said to him, "Have you believed because you've seen me? Blessed are those who have not seen and yet believe." All right. So Jesus offers him the chance. He says, "Here, see them, touch them." And then he says, "Do not be unbelieving, but believing." And to me, this is really interesting. I think a lot of times the common picture of what happens here is that Thomas accepts the invitation and does touch. The text never actually says that. I just find that curious. The text doesn't say that he touches him. So it's possible then he doesn't need to, that he's seen him, that this is enough for belief. But we are told what his reaction is. His reaction is, Thomas answered him and said, "My Lord and my God." And whatever nickname we give Thomas, this is by far the most full and complete confession of faith in Jesus in John's gospel account. Thomas is the one who, upon seeing Jesus, perhaps touching his wounds, but upon seeing him, comes to the immediate realization that he is both Lord, he's Messiah, and he's God, he's divine. Thomas understands, there's no other explanation for this, that he is truly the Son of God, that he is divine, and he is man. So he is the Messiah, and he is God. That's what he says to Jesus. He says, "My Lord, my God." So for all the grief we give Thomas, he has a remarkable confession. And I think we all credit goes to him for that. And then Jesus says, "Blessed are those who have not seen and have believed." And I very much dislike that this verse sometimes gets used by atheists who like to say that this, well, here it is, where even your own scriptures say you're being asked to take a leap of faith. But Jesus doesn't say believe on nothing. He says, "Blessed are those who," he says, "have you believed because you've seen me?" And then right after this, it says that these things are written so we would believe. Is the written evidence itself not evidence? I mean, that's what bothers me about this. We're not asked to take a leap of faith. We're asked to read the eyewitness account of the disciple whom Jesus loved. And this is the evidence, along with three other gospel accounts. So Jesus isn't asking us to believe with no evidence. In fact, we have the evidence. We've been studying it all quarter. Yes, we have another comment.
Yeah, Brian, this is one of my favorite parts of the whole Bible, and maybe for a different reason than the obvious, but one of the things I find that's truly amazing here is how easily it is for us to give up on people and things. And yet this right here shows us that sometimes it takes us going the extra mile to have the kind of faith that we all really want to have. And so I've heard that, well, you're asking us to step out on faith. No, sometimes people need, because of the things that happen in their life, the ability to have a little more. And so it always reminds me, never give up on people.
That's a great comment. Jesus, of course, did not give up on Thomas, and look at the confession he got from Thomas. We have another comment up here for Mary.
I like the assurance, like you say, of the scriptures. And Peter says that the genuineness of your faith, it's genuine, it's not something that's not real, being much more precious than gold and that perishes, though it is tested by fire, may be found to praise, honor, and glory at the revelation of Jesus Christ, whom having not seen, Peter's writing to people who had not seen Christ, having not seen, though now you do not see him, yet believing, you rejoice with joy inexpressible, full of glory. We have genuine faith based on who Christ really is.
Yep, I appreciate that. Thank you. Thank you for that verse. And then again, these apostles, these men saw Jesus in the flesh. They saw the risen Jesus. Mary Magdalene saw the risen Jesus. And that gives us a flavor of what John means when he writes in his prologue in John 1, verse 14, when he says, "And the Word became flesh and dwelt among us, and we have seen his glory, glory as of the only Son from the Father, full of grace and truth." That statement is embodied in what Thomas just confessed here. At that moment, they knew they had seen the Word become flesh. They knew they had seen the only Son from the Father in the person. And it happens at this moment when Thomas, when he reveals himself to Thomas, and Thomas makes this great statement of faith. So here's the concluding verse here at the end of the main part of John. It says, "And truly Jesus did many other signs in the presence of his disciples, which are not written in this book. But these are written that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that believing you may have life in his name." So again, this is the purpose of this book. This entire book is given to us so that we may believe, and that we may believe these things, that Jesus is the Christ, that he's the Son of God, same thing Thomas just confessed, we are supposed to believe that, and that believing you may have life in his name. So that is the reward for the belief. This idea of belief was a dominant theme throughout the entire book of John. It is used by some counts 99 times in this gospel account. It's more, the word believe or belief or believed is used more than in Matthew, Mark, Luke combined. It's used in more than all the letters of Paul combined. And here in this chapter, we see sort of the ultimate fulfillment of where this was all headed. We have John going into the tomb. It says he saw and believed. We have Thomas declaring, "Well, I need to see myself or else I can't believe." Jesus challenges him not, he says, "Don't disbelieve, but believe." And then we have that statement we just read, the full statement of belief by Thomas, "My Lord and my God." And now here we're told all of this is given to us so that we might believe. So belief is by far the dominant theme of this whole book. This is given to us so we would have the same belief. I'm going to go through this part rather quick so we can talk about the last chapter. But this is just a reminder that there are two endings to John. So we have this concluding verses here at verse 20. And then there's another chapter, and we have another conclusion that reads almost identically. But that means we have an epilogue to this story. And I think the epilogue is given to us in balance to the prologue at the beginning. Remember, there's a poem at the beginning of John chapter 1 that goes back to creation. And then now we have this epilogue where it's going to look forward to the role of the church I don't know what happened to my arrows there, but John 1 begins within the beginning, and chapter 21 ends with Jesus saying, until I come. And so this is meant to span all of time, and that's what the epilogue is given to us for. So both portions end with roughly the same thing, that talks about the signs that were given these that so that we could believe. And at the end of chapter 21, the writer tells us that there were many other signs, and if all the things that Jesus did were written, the world itself could not contain the books. But both of these concluding statements are pretty much in parallel. They're the same number of words in Greek. They don't look it in English, but they're the same number of Greek words, and they bookend this epilogue. Now, what happens in the epilogue? Well, now we're in Galilee, so we have a resurrection scene in Jerusalem, but now we also have one in Galilee. And so we have Peter and the other disciples, and they've decided to go fishing. Peter says, I'm going fishing. It's almost as though they don't know what to do now. They're like, well, what now? and they catch nothing. And then Jesus is there on the shore, only they don't know that he's there, and they don't know it's him. It says, just as day was breaking, Jesus stood on the shore, and yet the disciples did not know that it was Jesus. Jesus said to them, children, do you have any fish? And they answered him and said, no. And he said to them, cast a net on the right side of the boat, and you will find some. So they cast it, and now they were not able to haul it in because of the quantity of fish. That disciple whom Jesus loved therefore said to Peter, it is the Lord. And when Simon Peter heard that it was the Lord, he put on his outer garment, for he was stripped for work, and he threw himself into the sea. And the other disciples came in the boat, dragging the net full of fish, for they were not far from the land, but about 100 yards off. And it says, when they got out on land, they saw a charcoal fire in place with fish laid on it and bread. So Jesus already had fish and bread. By the way, we see here Jesus eating with his disciples, which is, again, something a spirit doesn't do, right? This is very much evidence that Jesus is bodily raised. He is doing things that humans do. He is eating with his disciples. So anyway, Jesus tells them they don't catch any fish, and he says, cast the net on the right side, and then they have a great multitude that are caught. And then we're even told that the number here, 153, we see that down in the next section in verse 9. A lot of thought has been given to, is there any special meaning to this 153? I don't know, but I do know John knows the exact number, right? So again, this is a detail that sticks out to him. This is a memory he has. So you can imagine their amazement, right? They're counting them all up. They're amazed at what's just occurred, and John remembers it down to the number. John recognizes Jesus. Peter dives out of the boat. Here we have a scene where Jesus has prepared the charcoal fire. He has food already for them, despite this large catch of fish. And then Jesus invites them. He says, come and eat breakfast. And then yet none of the disciples dared ask him, who are you? Knowing that it was the Lord. So again, we get this picture. They recognize him, but they don't, right? That there's something about him. There's something mysterious. They're frightened, even, it says. It says they didn't dare ask him, who are you? Maybe it hasn't quite sunk in what Thomas has confessed. Maybe they're still processing this as it's happening, right? But it's Jesus, but he's somehow even more than that. And so he's the man that they knew, and again, somehow even more. So I like that verse because it gives us a sense of the mystery they must have been experiencing. It's a very real, rings true as to something they would have actually thought in the moment. Now we get this conversation between Jesus and Peter. I think this is well known to us. Jesus asked Peter 3 times, says, do you love me? This is in parallel to Peter's 3-part denial when he says, I am not, I am not, I am not. When they asked, aren't you one of his disciples? Peter denied him 3 times, said, I am not. Both of these scenes, by the way, happen around a charcoal fire, which I think probably adds to the feelings that Peter is experiencing. He remembers perhaps the last time he was around a charcoal fire, that smell, that sensation when he betrayed Jesus. He denied even knowing him. And yet here's Jesus asking Peter, do you love me, three times. He says, feed my lambs, tend my sheep, feed my sheep. So Jesus is having this moment here with Peter. He's reconciling. He's sharing his own work with Peter. Of course, Jesus is the good shepherd. Jesus is the one who feeds the lambs, tends the sheep, feeds the sheep. Now here we have Jesus asking Peter to take up his work and do the same thing. Again, as he said in the previous chapter, as my Father sent me, so I'm sending you. He's tasking Peter with his own work. It says Peter's grieved when he was asked the third time. I think he's gotten is the point that he very much remembers. He's still in grief and remorse from denying Jesus. A lot has been made about the fact that the words say agape that Jesus uses, and then Peter says phileo. I don't know that we're supposed to read anything into that or not. But what I do know is we're supposed to know that Peter's remembering his denial. And that's what's causing Peter the most grief, is that he denied Jesus, and he still feels remorseful for that. But this work that Jesus gives to Peter is going to come with a cost. He says, most assuredly, I say to you, when you were younger, you girded yourself and walked where you wished. But when you are old, you will stretch out your hands and another will gird you and carry you where you do not wish. And he tells Peter to follow him. He says, follow me. So he's telling Peter that you will follow my path someday, even to death, even to the point where you are bound and carried away to a place where you don't wish. And then Peter, at the very end, asks a question about John. It says, the disciple whom Jesus loved was following behind, and Peter asks, Lord, what about this man? So here at the end of the book, we see Peter and John and Jesus together. Peter and John have played key roles throughout this whole book. Their roles are noted at the Last Supper, the arrest and the trial, the resurrection, and now their roles are going to be slightly different. So Peter is tasked to be a shepherd and to follow the path to the death that Jesus had. And John he corrects this idea here at the end. He says that, this is verse 23, so the saying spread among the brothers that this disciple was not to die. Yet Jesus did not say to him that he was not to die, but he said, if it is my will that he remain until I come, what is that to you? So I think John's role, which is slightly different from Peter's, is that he is the one who writes this book. He's the one that records the eyewitness testimony. He's the one that gives us the witness to last for all time, in a very real sense, until Jesus comes, right? And of course, we don't have a gospel account called Peter. But I think this is sort of Jesus giving different roles, different paths for these two inner circle disciples. But the point is, follow me. And with this, he's sort of encouraging them to put aside rivalry, envy, accept different roles. I want to thank everyone for your participation and attention during this class, and we'll begin the next quarter.